Chapter 9. The Istuli Plains. A quote from an Ainani proverb. The shape of virtue is inked in obscenity. Early summer, 20 new imperial year, 4132 year of the Tusk, the High Istuli.
I am the smoke that hangs from your cities, the Nonman screams. I am the whore that captivates, the beauty that chases and compels.
And they gather before him, some kneeling, others hanging back with reluctance and terror. One by one they open their mouths to his outstretched finger.
I am the plummet.
12 walkers, little more than gray shadows in the veils of dust, lean to the rhythm of their exertions. The forests, vast and hunted, are behind them. The sea, trackless and heaving, is behind them. The dead who mark their path are long rotted. The plains pass like a dream. Food becomes scarce. Zongis continually scans the ground for sign of foals or other rodents, leads them on a winding course, toward this or that high-circling bird of prey. Whenever he finds a warren, he directs the wizard to tear up the ground while the others stand ready with their weapons. Arcane lights prize the earth in broad sheets. When the Imperial tracker guesses true, most are killed outright, while the others are stunned or lamed enough to easily skewer. Fat-limbed rats, my Mara cannot help but think as she devours them, her face and fingers greased in the evening gloom. Because finding the warrens is uncertain, they heap uneaten carcasses on their backs. This is what kills Hilicus, sickness from spoiled meat. The 12 become 11. Starlight provides their sole illumination at night. The captain speaks only to cleric, long, murmuring exhortations that no one can quite hear. The others gather like shipwrecked survivors, small clots separated by gulfs of exhaustion. Galien holds court with Paquus and Zongis. The three gripe and joke in low, suspicious tones, and sometimes watch the others, only to look away when the subject of their scrutiny turns to question them. Conger and Wunnard rarely speak, but remain shoulder to shoulder, whether walking, eating, or sleeping. Sarl sits alone, skinnier and far less inclined to ape his former role as sergeant. My Mara catches him glaring at the captain from time to time, but she can never decide whether she glimpses love or murder in his eyes. Of the stone hags, only Kulb remains. Never has my Mara witnessed a man so gouged. But he awakens, wordlessly, joins their long, striding march, wordlessly. It seems he has forsworn all speech and thought, as luxuries belonging to the fat. He has abandoned his armor and his girdle. He has tied a string from the pommel of his broadsword, which he slings about his forehead, so he can carry the blade naked across his back. Once she catches him spitting blood. His gums have begun bleeding. She avoids all thought of her belly. Sometimes, while walking in the dusty cool of the morning, or the draught sun-glare of the afternoon, she catches herself squeezing her eyes shut and opening them, like someone warding much-needed sleep. The others are always there, trudging through their own dust and scattered file. As are the plains, stretching dun and white to the limit of the bleached sky, passing like a dream.
How I loved you, the Nonman weeps. So much I would have pulled down mountains.
Stars cloud the sky in sheets, vaulting the night with innumerable points of light. In the shadow of the false man, the scalpers bend back their heads, open their mouths in infant need, infant wonder.
Enough to forswear my brothers.
They wave their arms in exultation, cry out in laughing celebration.
Enough to embrace damnation!
Cole watches them from the dark. The wizard recites long-dead poets, his voice curiously warm and resonant. He argues metaphysics, history, even astrology. He is a wild old man, clad in rancid hides. He is a Gnostic mage from days of old. But he is a teacher most of all. The Curie, he says to her one evening. It sharpens the memory. Makes it seem as if, you know, everything you know.
It makes me happy, she replies, resting her cheek on her raised knees.
A beaming smile splits his beard. Yes, sometimes. A momentary frown clenches his brow. He shakes it into another smile. The plains pass like a dream. She sits with herself in the high grasses, thinking,
could I be this beautiful?
She finds herself fascinated by the line of her jaw, the way it curves like a chalice to the soft hook of her earlobe. She understands the pleasure that mirrors hold for the beautiful. She knows vanity. In a brothel, they endlessly primped and preened, traded fatuous compliments and envious gazes. Beauty may have been the coin of their subjugation, but it was the only coin they possessed, so they prized it the way drunks prize wine and liquor. Take away enough, and people will treasure their afflictions. If only to better accuse the world.
I know what you're doing, she whispers to the thing called Soma. And what am I doing?
There are differences, to be sure. It wears the rags that were once Soma's gowns for one. And the thing is filthier than she, something she would have not thought possible before encountering it here, away from the others. Especially about the face and neck, where remains of multiple raw feedings have sheathed and stained its skin. Her skin. Surrogation, she says. Consult's skin spies typically begin with a servant or a slave, someone who allows them to study their real target, learn their mannerisms, voice, and character. Once they've learned enough, they begin transforming themselves, sculpting their flesh, molding the cartilage bones, in preparation for the subsequent assassination and replacement of the target. It has even replicated the lean, starved look that has begun to afflict them all.
Your father has told you this?
Yes. And the growing curve of her lower belly.
You think this is what I'm doing?
What else would you be doing? A sudden sharpness pokes through her manner. She will show this thing, this beautiful thing.
Declaring your beauty, it replies.
No, Soma, do not play games with me. Nothing human passes through your soul because you have no soul. You're not real.
But I speak. How could I speak if I had no soul?
Parrots speak. You are simply a cunning parrot.
I fear I am more.
I can even prove it to you.
Can you now?
Now she's playing games, she realizes. Games when she has so many burning questions. One's crucial to their survival. Every night she rehearses them, but for some reason they no longer seem pertinent. If anything, they feel absurd, bloated with unreality, the kinds of questions fat priests might ask starving children. Even the central question, when she thinks of it, leaves her leaden with reluctance. And yet she needs to ask it, to lean heedless into the thing's menace, and demand an answer, to blurt, "What do you mean the non-men is trying to kill us?" But she cannot. And it has become as proper can be, avoiding things troubling and obvious, to play games with inhuman assassins. "A man comes to you saying," she begins with a sly smile, "do not believe anything I say, for I am a liar." She pauses to allow the words to resonate. "Tell me, thing. Why is this a paradox? Because it's strange for a liar to say such things. The response occasions a small flare of triumph. It's remarkable, really, witnessing things learned in the abstract happen in actuality, and yet further proof of her stepfather's divinity. She can even see the Aspect Emperor's luminous face, smiling and gentle, saying, "Remember, my Mara, if you fear, simply ask this question." The thing before her truly possesses no soul. But as dread as the fact is, it seems a farce. There, that is my proof.
Proof? How?
She feels as if she pretends the water has boiled, even though the fire has long since guttered. As if someone raises stone-cold bowls, smacks their lips, and spouts some homily about the way tea warms the soul, even as they shudder at the chill lining their collective gut. Only a soul can hold a paradox, she explains. Since the true meaning of paradox escapes you, you can only grasp non-paradoxical approximations. In this case, strange. Only a soul can comprehend contradictory truths.
If I'm not a soul, then what am I?
How has everything become such a farce? An abacus crafted of skin, flesh, and bone. A monstrous, miraculous tool. A product of the Techne.
That, too, is something special, is it not?
Something is wrong, she realizes. Their voices have waxed too loud. And the wizard, she knows, will be peering into the darkness after her, wondering, worrying. I must go. I've tarried too long. Cleric saw it first, scooped along distant tentacles of wind. A scarf of white and gold, the colors of the thousand temples, floating, coiling, and uncoiling. The first sign of humanity they had encountered since passing through the last of the Maori ruins weeks previous. Of course, a Commian was among the last to pick it out against the dun monotony of the distance. There, my Mara repeated time and time again, and pointing. There! At last he glimpsed it, twisting like a worm in water. He clenched his teeth following its meandering course, balled his fists. The great ordeal, he realized. Somewhere on this very plain, the host of Kellis and his believer kings marched the long road to Golgotharath. How close would they pass? But this worry, like so many other things, seemed unrooted. Yet another scarf floating across parched ground. Everything seemed to float lately, as if yanked from its native soil and carried on a slow flood of invisibility. Few men return the same after months or years of travel. A Commian knew this as well as anyone. Sheer exposure to different sights, different customs, different peoples, was enough to alter a man, sometimes radically. But in Akamian's estimation, the real impetus, what really changed men, was the simple act of walking and thinking, day after day, week after week, month after month. Innumerable thoughts fitted through the soul of the long traveler. Kith and kin were condemned and pardoned. Hopes and beliefs were considered and reconsidered. Worries were picked to the point of festering or healing. For those who could affirm the same thoughts endlessly, men like the captain, the trail typically led to fanaticism. But for those with no stomach for continuous repetition, men like Galien, the trail led to suspicion and cynicism, the conviction that thought was never to be trusted. For those who found their thoughts never quite repeating, who found themselves continually surprised by novel angles and new questions, the trail led to philosophy. To a wisdom that only hermits and prisoners could know. Akamian had always considered himself one of the latter, a long-walking philosopher. In his younger days, He would even take inventory of his beliefs and scruples, to better judge the difference between the man who had departed and the man who had arrived. He was what the ancient Canaan satirists called an alcumirsi, literally a milestone man, one who would spend his time on the road forever peering at the next milestone, a traveler who could not stop thinking about traveling. But this journey, arguably the most significant of his long life, was different somehow. Something was happening. Something inexplicable. Or something that wanted to be. His dreams had changed as well. The night they had camped atop the Hylor, he once again found himself one of many captives, chained in an ever-diminishing line, still toothless for scarce-remembered beatings, still nameless for the profundity of what he suffered. And yet everything was different. He glimpsed the flash of memories when he blinked, for one, images of ghastly torment, obscenities too extreme to be countenanced, the glimpse of Shrank hunched in frenzied rutting, the taste of their slaver as they arced and drooled across him, the stench of their black seed. Degradations so profound that his soul had kicked free his body, his past, his sanity. So he pinned his eyes wide in false wakefulness, stared over the wretches before him with a kind of mad glaring toward the opening that marked his destination. Where scrub and brush had enclosed the file before, he now saw gleaming bulkheads and curved planes of gold, a corridor of metal, canted as though part of an almost toppled structure where some great boat dragged ashore. Where the tunnel had ended in a clearing of some kind, he now saw a chamber, vast in implication, though he could see naught but the merest fraction, and illuminated with a kind of otherworldly light, one that rinsed the walls in watery arrhythmia, and sickened for staring. The Golden Room, he called it, and it was the sum of all horrors. The unseen horn would blare, scraping across intonations no human ear was meant to suffer. Shadows would rise from the threshold, and the procession would be heaved, staggering forward, two steps, never more. He would listen to the shrieks, infant in their intensity, as the Golden Room devoured yet another damaged soul. Thinking, "Please, let it end here." The trees, he had realized upon awakening, the dream had been refracted through their lethargic wrath, distorted. A forest tunnel, a forest clearing. Now the bark skin of the mop had fallen away, revealing the true locus of his dream captivity, one that he recognized instantly, yet was long in admitting. The dread ark, Min Oroikas. He now dreamed the experiences of some other soul, a captive of the consort, shuffling to his doom in the belly of wicked Golgotharath. And yet, despite the mad significance of his latest transformation, despite all the care and scrutiny he had heaped upon his dreams over the years, he found himself dismissing these ethereal missives with an inexplicable negligence. Even though their horror actually eclipsed his old dreams of the apocalypse, they simply did not seem to matter, for some reason. For some reason. The old wizard laughed sometimes, so little did he care. 17 days into the Itstuli Plains, the day following the scarf, Maimara suddenly asked him why he had fallen in love with her mother. Maimara was forever talking about the Empress, as she called her, always describing her in ways that lampooned and criticized. Often she would adopt her mother's tone and voice, lips pulled into a line, eyelids wary and low, an expression that strove to look impervious, yet seemed brittle instead. It was a habit that amused and alarmed the old wizard in equal measure. Although Akamian was forever defending Esmenet, as well as chiding my Mara for her lack of charity. He had always managed to avoid revealing his true feelings. His instinct was to keep his counsel when talking mothers to their children, even when adult. Motherhood, it seemed, meant too much to be trusted to something as sordid as truth. So he would tell her pleasant lies, the kind of polite observations designed to discourage further discussion. If she insisted, or, worse yet, pestered him with direct questions, he would bark and bristle until she relented. Too much pain, he would tell himself. And besides, he had become quite fond of acting the crabby old wizard. But this time he did neither. Why, she asked, out of all the women you have lain with, why love her? Because she possessed a sharp wit, he heard himself reply. That was why I returned, I think. That and her beauty. But your mother, she was always asking me questions about things, about the world, the past. Even my dreams fascinated her. We would lie in her bed sweating, and I would talk and talk, and she would never lose interest. One night she interrogated me until dawn gilded the cracks of her shutters. She would listen, and... He trailed into the marching silence, not so much stymied by the difficulty of what he wanted to say as astonished by the fact he spoke at all. When had confession become so easy? And what? And she believed me. Your stories, you mean, about the first apocalypse and the no-god? He glanced about as though wary about being overheard, when in truth he really did not care. That, but it was more, I think. She believed in me. Could it be so simple? And so he continued. He heard himself explaining things he never knew he understood. How doubt and indecision had so ruled his soul and intellect that he could scarce act without lapsing into endless recriminations. Why? Why? Always why? He heard himself explaining the horrors of his dreams and how they had frayed his nerves to the quick. He heard himself telling her how he had come to her mother weak, a man who would sooner hatch plots in his soul than take any real action. How Drusus Acamian, the only wizard in the three seas, had been a cringer and a coward. The strange thing is that he found himself actually yearning for those days, missing not so much the fear, perhaps, as the simple anguish of needing another. Living with her in Sumna, while she continued taking custom, sitting and waiting in the bustling agora, watching the to and fro of innumerable Sumnites, while images of her coupling with strangers plagued him gut and soul. Perhaps this explained what happened later, when she had climbed into Kellis's bed, believing that Acamian had perished in the Seriotic library. If there was any fact from his past that caused Acamian to both flinch and marvel, it was the way he had continued to love both of them after their joint betrayal. Despite the years, he never ceased bawling his fists at the pageant of memories. His awe of Kellis and the godlike ease with which he mastered the Gnosis, and his impotent fury when the man retired to lie with his wife. His wife! Esmonet, such a strange name for a whore. Fear, the old wizard said in resignation. I was always afraid with your mother.
Because she was a whore, Maimara said with more eagerness than compassion.
She was right. He had loved a whore and had reaped the wages accordingly. Perhaps the final days of the First Holy War simply had been a continuation of those early days in Sumna. The same hurt, the same rage, only yoked to the otherworldly glamour that was Anasarimber Kellis.
No, he said, because she was beautiful.
It seemed a proper lie. What I don't understand, Maimara explained with her air verbalizing something she had long debated in silence, is why you refused to hold her accountable. She was a caste menial, not sold into slavery like me. She chose to be a whore.
just as she chose to betray you.
Did she?
It seemed that he listened to his voice more than he spoke with it.
Did she what? Choose? Of course she did.
Few things are so capricious as choice, my girl. Seems simple to me. Either she chooses to be faithful or she chooses to betray. He glared at her.
And what about you? Were you chained to your pillow in Carathuzel? No? Does that mean you chose to be there? That you deserved everything you suffered? Could you not have jumped off the ship when the slavers she sold you to put out to sea? Why blame your mother for your willful refusal to run away?
Her look was hateful, but marred by the same hesitation that seemed to dog all their heated conversations of late. That moment of searching for the proper passion, as if willing away some reptilian fragment of self that simply did not care. My Mara, part of him realized, was injured because he had said something injurious, not because she felt any real pain. That capacity, it seemed, had been lost in the dark bowels of Kilauges.
"There are chains," she said dully, "and then there are chains."
"Exactly." A kind of humility haunted her manner after that, but one that seemed more motivated by weariness than any real insight. Even so, he welcomed it. Arrogance is ever the patron of condemnation. Though most all men lived in total ignorance of the ironies and contradictions that mortared their lives, they instinctively understood the power of hypocrisy. So they pretended, laid claim to an implausible innocence, to better sleep, to better condemn. The fact that everyone thought themselves more blameless than blameworthy, Agensis once wrote, was at once the most ridiculous and the most tragic of human infirmities. Ridiculous because it was so obvious and yet utterly invisible. Tragic because it doomed them to unending war and strife. There is more than strength in accusation. There is the presumption of innocence, which is what makes it the first resort of the broken-hearted. During the first years of his exile, Achaemenid had punished Esmenet in effigy innumerable times in the silent watches before sleep, too many times. He had accused, and he had accused. But he had lived with his grievances too long, it seemed, to perpetually condemn her for anything she might have done. No one makes the wrong decisions for reasons they think are wrong. The more clever the man, as the Nirani were fond of saying, the more apt he was to make a fool of himself. We all argue ourselves into our mistakes. And Esmenet was nothing if not clever. So he forgave her. He could even remember the precise moment. He had spent the bulk of the day searching his notes for the specifics of a certain dream, one involving a variant of Seswatha's captivity in Dagliash. He could no longer remember why it was important. Furious with himself, he had decided to climb down from his room to assist Garaeus with his wood-chopping. The odd blister, it seemed, helped focus his thoughts as well as steady his quill. The slave was doggedly hacking away at one of the several shorn trunks he had drawn to the crude hutch where they stored their wood. Grabbing what turned out to be the dull axe, Achaemenid began chopping as well. But for some bizarre reason, he could not strike the wood without sending chips spinning up into Garius's face. The first one went unmentioned. The second occasioned a frowning smile. The third incited outright laughter and a subsequent apology. The fifth chip caught the man in the eye, sent him to the water bucket blinking and grimacing. Once again, Achaemenid apologized, but only so far as was seemly between master and slave. Strangely enough, he had come to prize the genanic etiquette he so despised when traveling the flesh pots of the three seas. Afterward, he stood there, watching the man he owned rinse his left eye time and again, feeling somehow guilty and wronged at the same time. After all, he had meant to assist the man. Garaeus turned toward him, ruefully shook his head, and commended him for his supernatural aim. Achaemenid's vague ire evaporated, as it always did in the face of the man's relentless good nature, Then, impossibly, he caught the scent of the desert, as if somewhere just beyond the arboreal screens that fenced his tower, he would find the dunes of the mighty Carathay. And just like that, she was forgiven. Esmenet, the whore become empress. Numb to his fingertips, Acamian returned the axe to its nook. "Better to heed the gods," Garius had said in approval. Of course, habits like fleas are not so easy to kill, especially habits of thought and passion. But she was forgiven, nonetheless. Even if he wasn't finished accusing her, she was forgiven. And somehow, while walking with a band of killers through the empty heart of a dead civilization, he managed to explain this to Mymara. He told her about their very first meeting, about the bawdy way her mother had accosted him from her window. "Hey! Inani!" she had shouted down. It was the custom in Sumna to call the all-bearded foreigners Inani. "A man so swollen needs to take his ease, lest he bursts." "I was quite fat in those days," he said, answering Maimara's dubious look. And he told her about herself, or at least the memory of her that continued to haunt her mother. This was the summer after the famine. Sumna, the whole Nansar Empire, had suffered grievously. In fact, the poor had sold so many of their children into slavery that the Emperor issued an edict voiding all such sales between Nansar citizens the previous summer. Like most caste menials, your mother was too poor to afford citizenship. But exceptions were being issued by various tax farmers throughout the city. Your mother would have never told me about you, I think, were it not for the law. The 16th Edict of Manumission, it was called, I think. She needed the gold, you see. She was mad for gold, for anything she might use as a bribe. You gave it to her. Your mother never dreamed she could get you back. In fact, she never thought she would survive the famine. She literally believed she was sparing you her doom. You simply cannot imagine the straits she was in, the chains that shackled her. She sold you to Inani slavers, I think, because she thought the farther she could deliver you from the Nansirium, the better. So the Emperor's edict was useless. I tried to tell her, but she refused to listen. Really refused, he added with a chuckle, drawing a finger to a small scar he still sported on his left temple. Even still, she managed to secure the exception from a man, a monster named Pulpy Thorias, someone I still dream of killing. The first day the law went into effect, she went down to the harbor. I don't know about now, but back then the Ershi district, you know, the north part of the harbor, in the shadow of the Hegirna, was where the slavers held the markets. She refused to let me accompany her. It was something she needed to do on her own, I think. It was a strange thing for a man to enter the world of a damaged woman. The apparent disproportion between event and evaluation, the endless sinkholes that punished verbal wandering, the crazed alchemy of compassion and condemnation. It was a place where none of the scales seemed balanced, where the compass bowl never settled, and the needle never showed true north. You know, girl, I think that was when I truly fell in love with her, that day, so very hot, as humid as any day in the Sayut Delta. I sat on the very sill she used to accost men on the street below, watched her slender form swallowed by the mobs. For some reason, he could not conjure the image in his soul's eye. Instead, he glimpsed the eunuch fat man she had vanished behind in the press, his smile hooking his jowls, empires of dark soaking his armpits. Such is the perversity of memory. Small wonder the Nonman lapsed into madness. "She wasn't the only one," he continued. "Apparently thousands of exceptions have been sold, almost all of them counterfeit. Not that it would have mattered, given that you were in Carathuzel, far beyond the sway of the Emperor and his ill-considered law. The slavers had hired mercenaries in anticipation. There were riots. Hundreds were killed. One of the slavers' ships was set alight.
When I saw the smoke, I went out into the city to try and find her. He idly wondered whether anyone had seen as many smoking cities as he. Many, he decided, if the rumors he had heard regarding the wars of unification were true. Sorrel and the captain among them. "Men are fools at the best of times," he continued. "But when they gather in mobs, they lose whatever little reason they can claim when alone. Someone cries out, they all cry out. Someone bludgeons or burns, and they all bludgeon and burn. It's remarkable, really, and terrifying enough to send kings and emperors into hiding. I was forced to resort to the Gnosis twice just to reach the harbor, and this in a city where Korae were rife and sorcerers had their tongues scraped out with oyster shells. I actually remember little, just smoke, shadows running, bodies in the dust, and this cold that seemed to burn in the bottom of my gut. Even after so many years, the phantasmagoric feel of that afternoon still tickled. It had been one of the first times his waking life had approximated the shrieking madness of his dreams.
"Did you find her?"
my Mara asked. She had been walking with her head slouched, almost slung from her shoulders. It was an unlikely posture, a peculiar combination of reflection and defeat. "No."
"No? What do you mean, no?"
"I mean no. I remember thinking I found her. Along one of Hagerna's walls, lying face first in her own blood." The moment came back to him unbidden. He had been nauseated for smoke and worry, leaning his then fat body against what seemed a laborious incline. The sight of her struck all thought and breath and motion from him. He just stood there, teetering, while the screams and shouts continued to pipe in the near distance behind him. At first, he had simply known it was her. The same girlish form and piling black hair. Even more, the same mauve cloak. Though it struck him now that it might have only seemed the same cut and color. Fear has a way of rewriting things to suit its purposes. She had fallen, facing uphill, pigeon-toed, one arm slack along her side, the other bent beneath her torso. The blood had streamed along her edges, outlining her in black and crimson. He remembered horns sounding across the harbor, the shrial knights signaling, and how in their blaring wake a hush had fallen, allowing him to hear the tap-tap of her blood directly into the heart of the earth. She had fallen across one of Sumna's famed gutters. "But it wasn't her?" my Mara was asking. Several young men had raced past without so much as seeing them. With nerveless fingers he had reached down, certain she would be as light as bundled rags. She was not, and it reminded him of pulling stones out of wet beach sand as a child. He heaved the woman onto her back, revealed her sodden face, and stumbled back against the wall, falling to his rump. Joy and relief, unlike anything he would experience until the first holy war. "No," he replied. "Just some other unfortunate. Your mother had found her way back with nary a scrape." She had been sitting on her sill when he returned, staring down the slots between the opposing tenements toward the harbor. The room was dark, so that she seemed to glow from where he stood in the doorway. "She never spoke of you again. Not to me, or anyone. Not until she succumbed to Kellis." They both fell silent for a trudging time, as though struggling to absorb the sideways significance of his tale. They stared at the sparse crowd of scalpers before them. Paquas with a vole carcass slung across his great tulwar, which he wore holstered diagonally across his back. Galien, bobbing at his side, his stride as quick and nimble as his tongue. Conger and Wannard, shuffling like hurried ghosts, their Galeoth war knots so haphazard that their hair fell in filthy rags to their shoulders. Cull, lurching and limping, his shoulders as sharp as sticks. "Your mother is a survivor, girl," Akamian finally hazarded. "Same as you." He found himself thinking that perhaps she had died that day in the harbor, or a part of her. The Esmonet he had found was not the Esmonet who had left him, that much was certain. Her melancholy had lifted, if anything. He remembered thinking that she had actually healed in some way. Before that day, a kind of inward lethargy had always blunted the appetite of her curiosities, the wicked edge of her witticisms. Or so it seemed at the time. "Let the outside sort her sins," he added. He typically shied away from this kind of talk. The world seemed too much a rind pulled across something horrific, and death loomed as the only terror. Some day his sins would be sorted as well, and he did not need my Mara and her eye to know his ultimate fate. He walked, waiting for my Mara to pinch him with more questions and unflattering observations. But she kept her face turned to the distances before them, the wind whisking openness, the endless lines. You would not know the world was crooked, he thought, living on the plains. Perhaps because they had been speaking Aenone, he found himself recalling the time he had spent in Carathusel, spying on the scarlet spires, and of this old drunk, Posidemus, he called himself, who would ply him with stories at a tavern called the Holy Leper. The man who claimed to have survived 7 naval battles and no less than 5 years as a captive of the Shearese pirates would speak of nothing but his wives and mistresses. He would describe, in excruciating detail, how each had betrayed him in this or that humiliating respect. A Camion would sit listening to the cow-eyed wretch, alternately scanning the crowd and nodding in false encouragement, telling himself that few things were more precious to a man than his shame. The very sense endless drink stripped from him, and that, he realized with no small amount of dismay, was what seemed to be happening here, on the long road to Ishwal. Endless intoxication, and with it, the slow strangulation of shame. What good was honesty when it carried no pain? Dust on the horizon, human smells on the hot wind. Fleet, they sprinted across the grasses, running low so that the weeds clawed their shoulders, their numbers scattered wide so that the dust of their approach would not alert their prey. They howled insults at the hated sun. They were sleek creatures, tireless and unrelenting, in the prosecution of their dread appetites. They took dirt for sustenance, violence for bliss. They wore the faces of their enemy, inhumanly beautiful when calm, twisted grotesqueries when aroused. Shrank, weapons of an ancient war, raging a dead world. They could smell them, the trespassers. They could see the lobes of flesh, the bloody pockets they would cut for their coupling, the eyes wide with unspeakable horror. Though generations had passed since their ancestors had last encountered men, the fact of them had been stamped into their flesh. The aching splendor of their screams, the heat of their bleeding, the twitching glory of their struggles. They loped like wolves, scuttled like spiders. They ran for truths they did not know, for verities written in their blood. They ran for the promise of violation, only to be astonished by a human figure rising from wicks of scrub and grass. A woman. Baffled, they tripped to a walk, closed about her in a broad arc. The wind flowed over her limbs, rifled through her hair, her rags, drawing with it the sediment that was her scent. Man, rot, feces, and something else. Something at once alarming and alluring. They formed fences about her, swaying and screeching, brandishing crude weapons, or mewling in confused apprehension. Their chieftain approached, his arms thrown down and back to drag knives through the powdery turf. He stood before her, nearly as tall, flies buzzing about rotted leathers that clotted him.
"What are you?"
he barked. "A child of the same father," she said. The chieftain began stomping. He bared his teeth, gnashed them for the woman to see.
"Father! Father! We have no fathers save the earth!"
She smiled a mother's smile. "But you do, and they deny you this path."
"Kill! Kill you! Kill! Murder! Fuck the others!"
"Yet you have no hunger for me."
"No hunger,
because we are children of the same fathers."
"Kill!" the chieftain shrieked. "Kill! Murder! Fuck!"
He shook his jaws like a wolf disputing a bone, raised his pitted knives to the featureless sky. The thing called Maimara leapt high over the chieftain's wagging head. Sunlight sparked from bared steel. It somersaulted with preternatural languor, landed in a warrior stance. Behind its back, the chieftain jerked, shrieked, clawed the air, as if trying to snatch at the violet blood spouting from his neck. The beast spun into the dust, little more than a twitching shadow behind screens of chalk. "We are the children of the same fathers," the woman said to the others. "Do you smell the true power of this?" A raucous swell of howls. "The Black Heaven will call you very soon." She smiled at the groveling obscenities. "He will call you very soon."
"What was it like?" she asks. "Meeting Kellis for the first time, I mean."
The old wizard's reply is typically long-winded. Agensis, he tells her, was fond of chiding his students for confusing assent with intellect. Apparently this confusion was what made obviously profound souls so troubling and so rare. "You, my girl, are the ground of your assumptions. No matter how bent your cubit may be, it is the very definition of straight for you. So, when another comes to you with their carpenter's string, well, let's just say they will necessarily come up short to the degree to which their assumptions deviate from yours, and it will strike you as obviously so. No matter how wrong, how foolish you are, you will think you know it. In your stomach, as the Galeoth say."
"So true wisdom is invisible? You're saying we can't see it when we encounter it?"
"No, only that we have great difficulty recognizing it."
"Then what made my stepfather different?"
The old wizard walked in silence for what seemed a long while, pondering the kick of his boots through the leathery grasses. "I've spent many hours mulling this. Now, you see, he possesses the authority. He is the mighty, all-knowing Aspect Emperor. His listeners come to him with their yardsticks in hand, actually seeking his correction. But back then, well, he was little more than a beggar and a fugitive." His tone is halting, pensive. He has the manner of a man surprised by things so familiar they have become thoughtless. "He had a gift for showing you the implications of things," he says, then trails into the silence of second thoughts. His brow furrows, his lips purse within the shaggy profile of his beard. "Agensis was forever saying that ignorance is invisible," he begins again, "and that this is what fools us into thinking we know the truth of anything, let alone complicated matters. He thought certainty was a symptom of stupidity, the most destructive one. But at the risk of offending the great teacher, or his ancient shade anyway, I should say that not all ignorances are equal. I think there are truths, profound truths, that we somehow know without knowing." Maimara glances around the way she often does when they have conversations like this. Paquas is the nearest, his harness sagging, his black skin chalked by dust. Galeon trudges nearby, the two have become inseparable. Cleric strides more than walks several paces ahead, his scalp gleaming white in the wide sky sun. Sorrel lags with Cull, his face pulled into a perpetual grimace. The skin-eaters. They look more like a scattered mob of refugees than a warlike company on a quest. This, Akavian says, still gazing into his reminiscences, this was Kellis's Noshi, his genius. He could look into your eyes and pluck these half-known truths from you, and so, within heartbeats of speaking with him, you would begin doubting your own cubit, and begin looking more and more toward his measure. She feels her eyes wide in comprehension. A deceiver could ask for no greater gift. The wizard's look is so sharp that at first she fears she has offended him. But he has that appreciative gleam in his eyes, the one she has come to prize. In all my years, he continues, I have never quite understood worship, what happens to souls when they prostrate themselves before another. I've been a sorcerer for far too long, and yet I did worship him. For a time. So much so I even forgave him the theft of your mother. He shakes his head as if trying to ward away bees, looks away to the stationary line of the horizon. A cough kicks through him. Whatever worship is, he says, I think it involves surrendering your cubit, opening yourself to the perpetual correction of another. Having faith in ignorance, she adds with a wry grin. His laughter is so sudden, so mad with hilarity, that fairly all the scalpers turn toward them. The grief you must have caused your mother, he cries. Even though she smiles at the joke, a part of her stumbles in errant worry. When has she become so clever? The Kyrie, she realizes. It quickens more than the step. Wary of the sudden attention, they stay their tongues. The silence of endless exertion climbs over them once again. She stares out toward the northern horizon, at the long divide between sky and earth. She thinks of Kellis and her mother making love in a distant desert. Her hand drifts to her belly. But her thoughts dare not follow. Not yet. She has the sense of things bending. The world is old and miraculous, and is filled with deep despair that none truly know. The non-man, Mamara has come to understand, is proof of this. There was a time, he says, when the world shook to the stamping chorus of our march. Dusk rolls the plains farther reaches into darkness and gloom. The wind buffets, hard enough to prickle with grit. Thunderheads scrawl across the sky, dark and glowing with internal discharges, but rainless save for the odd warm spit. The non-man stands before them, naked to the waist, one held in the eyes of ten. His hairless form is perfect and cast in proportion, the very image of manly grace and strength, a statue in a land without sculptors. There was such a time. Thunder rolls across the mocking skies, and the scalpers crane their gazes this way and that. It alarms the soul, thunder on the plain. The eyes turn to shelter when the heavens crack, and plains are naught but absence of shelter. Exposure drawn on and on across the edge of the horizon. The plains offer no place to hide, only directions to run. A time when we, Cleric says, when we were many, and when these depravities, these skinnies were few. There was a time when your forefathers wept at the merest rumor of our displeasure, when you offered up your sons and daughters to turn aside our capricious fury. She cannot yank her gaze from him, and Cariol, he is a mystery, a secret she must know, if she and Akamian were to be saved. His aspect has become a compulsion for her, like a totem or even an idol, something that rewards the ardor of its observation. The most foolish among us, Cleric continues, has forgotten more than your wisest will ever know. Even your wizard is but a child stumbling in his father's boots. You are but twig-thin candles, burning fast and bright, revealing far more than your span allows you to fathom. He bends back his head until the line of his jaw forms a triangle above the banded muscle of his neck. He shouts heavenward, mouthing words that pool blue and brilliant white. Then, miraculously, he steps into the sky, arms out, rising until the clouds become a kind of mantle about his shoulders, a wind-blown cloak of smoke and warring interior lights. "But now look at us!" he booms down to their astonished shadows. "Diminished, perpetually foundering, lost without memories, persecuted as false, hunted by the very depths we warred to uncover, the very darkness we sought to illuminate!" He hangs above them. He lowers his radiant gaze. His tears burn silver with refracted light. Thunder crashes, 1,000 hammers against 1,000 shields. This is the paradox, is it not? The longer you live, the smaller you become. The past always dwarfs the present, even for races as fleeting as yours. One morning you awaken to find now, this very moment, little more than a spark in a cavern. One morning you awaken to find yourself so much less. In Cariol, she thinks, Ishroy. Less than what you wanted. Less than what you once were. She is in love, she realizes. Not with him, but with the power and wonder of what he was. One day you, who have never been mighty or great, will ask where the glory has gone. Failing strength, failing nerve, you will find yourself faltering at every turn, and your arrogance will grow brittle, defensive. Perhaps you will turn to your sons and their overshadowed ardor. Perhaps you will seal yourself in your mansion, as we did, proclaiming contempt for the world, rather than face its cruel measure. She is more in his presence, she decides. She will always be more, whether he flees or dies, or utterly loses himself in the disorder that is his soul. For knowing him, cleric. One day you, who have never been mighty or great, will peer through the maze of your depleted life and see that you are lost. He abandons his mantle of clouds, sinking as though on a wire. He sets foot upon the powder-dry earth. Mamara leans forward with the wizard and the other scalpers. Their mouths hang slack with drool. "Lost like us," he murmurs, reaching for the wonder that hides in his pouch. The thunderheads continue their march into the obscurity of night. The rain, as always, refuses to fall.